From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, part one of our interview with the King of Horror, Stephen King. He'll read from his new book and tell us what he likes about being scared. Also, an argument against Afrocentrism. We talk with Harvard professor Kwame Anthony Appiah. Appiah is from Ghana. His new book is about what it means to be African. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new album by Italian pianist Maurizio Pollini. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. United Nations envoy Rolf Ikeas says the situation in Iraq has become more difficult now that UN inspectors have been forced to leave the agriculture ministry. But he says he's still hoping the dispute can be resolved diplomatically. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
UN inspectors ended their vigil outside a government office building in Baghdad early today after a series of street protests against them appeared to grow more volatile. Speaking on CNN today, Ikeas said the Iraqis had chosen to put UN personnel under direct pressure, and as a result, the situation had grown more difficult. But he said efforts to resolve the crisis are still underway. The dispute began on July 5th when inspectors tried to get into the agriculture building to search for missile documents but were denied entry. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said today that the U.S. is increasingly concerned about Iraq's continuing defiance of the U.N. Once again, he said the U.S. has not ruled out any option to end the crisis, including the use of military force against Iraq. In New York, this is Jim Zeroli reporting.
The reputed head of the Medellin cocaine cartel is reported to be missing after a fight with guards at his luxury prison in Colombia. Officials said they tried to move Pablo Escobar and his top lieutenants to a military jail after they learned that he was still ordering the murders of his rivals from inside his prison. Escobar and his men reportedly overpowered their guards, seized guns, and took hostages. At least two people are said to have been killed during the fight. The hostages have been freed by army commandos. A government official told reporters that Escobar's whereabouts are unknown, although he's still thought to be somewhere in the prison. Democratic presidential nominee Bill Clinton and running mate Al Gore brought their post-convention bus tour to an end today in St. Louis before the largest crowd of the trip. Mark Minnelli of member station KWMU reports.
A crowd of more than 40,000 in downtown St. Louis heard Clinton and Gore talk about jobs, education, health care, and economic growth, and the crowd liked what they heard. As on every stop of the 1,000-mile bus tour from New York City, Clinton drove home the message that the American people want change, and that he and running mate Al Gore are the agents of that change.
So if you're sick and tired of the way it's been going, if you want the American people in control again, if you believe your country is still the greatest country in the world again, if you think we can compete and win again, you give Al Gore and I a chance to bring America back.
Clinton and Gore now head back to their home states for a brief rest prior to the Republican convention and the official start of the presidential campaign. For National Public Radio, I'm Mark Minnelli in St. Louis.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials lost 30 points to close at 3,277. This is NPR. United Nations envoy Cyrus Vance met today with South African President F.W. de Klerk as part of his effort to restart power-sharing talks. The former U.S. Secretary of State will hold separate meetings tomorrow with leaders of the African National Congress and the Inkatha Freedom Party. An independent investigation of last month's Boipatong massacre in South Africa has condemned the police response to the killings as woefully inadequate, but the investigators said they found no evidence supporting charges of police complicity in the massacre. NPR's Ann Cooper reports.
A team of British police experts conducted the investigation at the invitation of a South African government commission studying violence. In its detailed report, the British team cited numerous shortcomings in forensics, in police questioning of suspects, and in police relations with township crowds following the Boipatong attack, in which more than 40 people died. Some Boipatong residents have charged that police were present during the massacre, but the British team said it found no evidence to support those claims. Nevertheless, its scathing analysis of police procedures is another blow to security forces who are already targets of contempt in South Africa's black townships. I'm Ann Cooper in Johannesburg.
General Electric Company admitted today that it defrauded the United States government of almost $27 million in the sale of military equipment to Israel. The Justice Department said that GE pleaded guilty to diverting money from the U.S.-financed F-16 jet engine program carried out with the Israeli Air Force from 1984 to 1990. Federal lawyers said that GE has entered into a plea bargain in which it will pay $69 million in fines, penalties, and damages. The charges against GE include the diversion of millions of dollars as a bribe to a former Israeli Air Force general. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest loves to scare people, and millions of people agree he does it brilliantly. It would be difficult to come up with a writer more popular than Stephen King. Even books he wrote under a pseudonym became bestsellers. Lots of his books have been made into movies, including Misery, Carrie, The Shining, The Dead Zone, Cujo, and Pet Sematary. Stephen King's new book is Gerald's Game. As the book opens, a married couple is in their forest cabin. They're ready to play their S&M sex game. She's on the bed, her wrists are cuffed to the bedposts. He's undressing. She realizes she's tired of this game. It seems stupid, ridiculous, and corny. But she can't get her husband to stop, and that makes her furious. As he forces himself on her, she kicks him where it hurts most. He collapses, suffers a heart attack, and dies. And she is alone, cuffed to the bed, in the middle of the woods. Now the horror really begins. I asked Stephen King what made him think about how corny sex games could be.
Actually, Gerald's Game started with the concept of the woman being chained to the bed. I'd written a book before where a woman and a small child were stuck in a car that was sort of surrounded, if you will, by a rabid St. Bernard. That book was called Cujo. And essentially what a lot of that book was two people in a very small room, although it did have a shifting perspective so that it went to other characters. And I thought originally this was the takeoff point for the book. Wouldn't it be interesting to see what would happen if you had one character in a room? The question then became, what caused this woman to be in this room by herself? And the answer that I came up with was bondage. She's handcuffed to a bed. And that forced me to sort of consider what causes people to do this sort of thing. And so once I'd set up the situation, I knew what it was going to be. I went in and read a little bit about it and thought a little bit about it. And the whole thing struck me as a little bit Victorian. There was something very snidely whiplash about the whole thing, and I tried to get that into the book.
Well, you do in a very funny way. I mean, the husband says to his wife as she's handcuffed to the bedpost, he says, "I'll teach you me proud beauty."
Yes, exactly.
Pronouncing beauty the way the landlord in a bad Victorian melodrama might.
You can almost see him waxing his mustaches, can't you?
Right, right, right. So you got the corniness and the danger of this kind of S&M sex play. In an interview a few years ago, you once said that one of the major reasons that you've been left alone is that your books are fairly asexual. Is this a change for you?
Well, it is and it isn't. You know, Peter Straub, with whom I collaborated on a book once called The Talisman, once joked and said, "Stevie hasn't discovered sex yet." But actually, I never saw any particular reason to go into sex unless it formed an integral part of the plot. It never had before, and here it does. You know, it's a little bit like that story that you sometimes hear about the little kid. Everybody assumes that he's mute. He doesn't say anything until he's 4 years old, and then one day in perfectly articulated English, he says to his mother, "Mother, may I have a glass of water?" And she says, "You talk. Why didn't you ever say anything before?" And he says, "All my needs were met. I never had to. This is, you know, the first time that it came up." So for me, this was the first time that sex came up in the course of you know, as it being a main element in terms of driving the plot. And it gave me a chance to take a look at a wide range of not only sexual material, but I don't know what you call it, stuff that ranged from the pornographic to the merely titillating. And a lot of what I saw through the considering eye of somebody who was planning to write about this, who used this as a building block, was a little disturbing. It seemed to me that there was a lot of stuff about men wanting to be empowered, to be in control in a way that struck me at least as essentially unhealthy, which in turn kicked off a whole sort of subplot, a center of the book that has to do with child molestation and maybe where some of these things come from.
Mm-hmm. This is hardly, though, the first time you've tried writing about sex. You once tried to write a porn novel while you were still in college. But you
couldn't
did.
Do it. I did actually try to write a porn novel when I was in college. But you have to realize that I was stony broke. I was living in a place called the University Cabins, living on fried Cheerios and peanut butter and beer. And I'd read in a writer's magazine that there were a couple of publishing companies, I think one of them was Olympia Books, that would pay $600 to $800 cash on acceptance for porno novels that ran from, I think, 25,000 to 40,000 words. I read a couple of things from the market and thought, I can do that in $600 isn't much, but I can do it in 10 days, and that's a living wage, and at least it will buy some hamburger to go with the fried Cheerios. And so I tried, but I just couldn't make it happen. I mean, I reached a point where I just tipped over, and what I was writing at that moment was a scene where two twin sisters are having lesbian sex in a birdbath, and I got to that point and I just said, hey, no, I'm sorry, I can't do this.
Now, what was it about that scene that you couldn't take any further?
It wasn't the fantasy element. I'm not sure I can answer your question. I'm very comfortable with fantasy, as people who've read my books for years know, but I just couldn't believe it anymore myself. I think that one of the integral things about fantasy that makes it palatable to readers is that if the writer actually believes it himself, at least while he's writing it, and at this point I just collapsed into, I can remember very clearly sitting in front of the typewriter, which was on the old kitchen table, and just laughing until tears rolled out of my eyes and just throwing the whole thing in the wastebasket. It wasn't happening for me.
Let's get Stephen King to the kind of gore and terror and suspense that you create. There's a scene in Gerald's Game, your new novel, that I'd like you to read from. And this is a scene in which the wife is still handcuffed to the bedpost. Her husband is laying dead on the floor, and a stray vicious dog from the area has walked into the house and has started dining on the woman's dead husband. Would you read it for us?
I sure will. Gerald's widow's peak was in disarray, probably as a result of the dog's licking the blood out of it. But his glasses were still firmly in place. She could see his eyes, half open and glazed, glaring up from their puffy sockets at the fading sun ripples on the ceiling. His face was still a mask of ugly red and purple blotches, as if even death had not been able to assuage his anger at her sudden capricious. Had he seen it as capricious? Of course he had. Change of mind. Let go of him, she told the dog, but her voice was now meek and sad and strengthless. The dog barely twitched its ears at the sound of it and didn't pause at all. It merely went on pulling the thing with the disarrayed widow's peak and the blotchy complexion. This thing no longer looked like Disco Gerald, not a bit. Now it was only dead Gerald, sliding across the bedroom floor with a dog's teeth buried in its flabby biceps. A frayed flap of skin hung over the dog's snout. Jessie tried to tell herself it looked like wallpaper, but wallpaper did not, at least as far as she knew, come with moles and a vaccination scar. Now she could see Gerald's pink, fleshy belly, marked only by the small caliber bullet hole that was his navel. His penis flopped and dangled in its nest of black pubic hair. His buttocks whispered along the hardwood boards with ghastly, frictionless ease. Abruptly, the suffocating atmosphere of her terror was pierced by a shaft of anger so bright it was like a stroke of heat lightning inside her head. She did more than accept this new emotion. She welcomed it. Rage might not help her get out of this nightmarish situation, but she sensed it would serve as an antidote to her growing sense of shocked unreality. "You bastard," she said in a low, trembling voice. "You cowardly, slinking bastard."
That's Stephen King reading from his new novel, Gerald's Game. Do you think of yourself as having taken the horror novel to a kind of more physically explicit place than it had ever been before?
Yeah, I think that to some degree I did do that. I think probably I've been surpassed in that area by some of the people who've come after me. I'm thinking mostly of Clive Barker.
Yeah.
But you realize that when I started reading and experiencing horror, some of it that I was reading and experiencing came from a very graphic wellspring. And I'm thinking about the horror comics of the 1950s, things like Tales from the Crypt and the Vault of Horror that can now be seen on home box office. And at the same time, I was discovering horror movies. I usually went by myself in the afternoon to the Highway Theater in Stratford, Connecticut, which is still there, incidentally, and saw things like I Was a Teenage Werewolf with Michael Landon, or I Was a Teenage Frankenstein, or whatever it happened to be. And it was there that I started to see that it might be possible to combine some of the classic elements with some of the things that I was seeing in the schlock press and the schlock movies.
When you would see movies like this, did they scare you or just amuse you?
No, they scared me. You have to remember that we're talking 10 or 11 years old, and even with a picture like Teenage Monster, where the flying saucer appeared to be a cool cigarette filter tip with a sparkler stuck in it, that it looked real to me because I was at a young and very credulous age. And one of the other things that I sensed as time went past and I got a little more discriminating in my ability to detect special effects, if not necessarily my sense of taste, was that when I wrote it, you never saw the zipper going up the monster's back, that when the imagination was in charge of special effects, they were always perfect as the book was, anyway.
Mm-hmm. What did you like about being scared when you were young?
I liked the total surrender of emotional control. It was very important to me, and I would almost be willing to say sort of a lifesaver. I'd been raised in a family where emotional control was a really important thing. You weren't supposed to show you were afraid. You weren't supposed to show that you were in pain or frightened or sad. Happiness was permissible as long as it didn't go too far, because then one might be considered to be almost insane if one got too happy. So that emotional control was, you know, sort of a requirement. And all the movies, my brother, David, was crazy about Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin. That was his emotional release. It's all a form of emotional seduction. And for me, the terror was what really appealed to something that I think is probably just inside people, that there isn't any logical way to explain it. But I loved it, and I loved giving up that control.
Now, what about when you passed real terror? I mean, for instance, if you would pass a car accident, would you look or turn the other way?
I can't remember that a lot of that ever happened in my life. What I can remember is making a very clear and conscious differentiation between make-believe horror like I Was a Teenage Werewolf and something real that happened. When I was a kid, at around the same time that Michael Landon was playing that werewolf, the make-believe werewolf, there was a kid named Charlie Starkweather who took his girlfriend, Carol Ann Fugate, and the two of them went on a killing spree across the Midwest. They killed, I don't know, 10 or 11 people in Nebraska and then over in Wyoming where they were captured. And he was put to death in the electric chair. And I kept a scrapbook about these people. You know, I would cut out the items and paste them in this scrapbook that I had. And my mother was very disturbed about it. This was in the mid-50s, and it was a time when child psychology was not exactly in vogue. But I think that if it had been, she probably would have sent me to one. I think that I can remember her saying, why are you interested in these people, Stephen? What is it? And what I was not able to explain at 10 or 11 years old was, I want to know these people if I ever run into them. not because they attract me, but because they scare the hell out of me. I want to know what the real beast in the real world looks like so I can steer clear of him or her or them.
Stephen King is my guest. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Stephen King is my guest. He has a new novel called Gerald's Game. To write the kind of fiction that you do, you really have to think about how people respond when they're terrified and how they deal with pain. How they deal with pain and with fear and terror. Do you handle pain well, and has that ability ever really been tested?
You know, I don't think anybody knows how they deal with pain. Everybody's pain is so individual. And so we have no basis for comparison. I think that pain is really the ocean that's between us. You know, I think it was John Donne said, no man is an island. But in fact, I'm sorry, John, but we are. And when you're dying of cancer, you do it alone. And when you have migraine headaches, which is something that I'm prone to, you do that alone. But if I have a really terrible headache, what I call one of my headbusters, I wonder how that would stack up against someone else's pain. But I don't know, because there's no way to tell. There's no valid basis for comparison because we don't feel each other's pain. The interesting thing to me, more interesting than pain in my life or the comparative levels of that sort of thing, is that experiences about pain and experiences of extreme terror, I think, make it possible to see the world that we live in, the mundane, everyday world, in much greater detail. Small things, unimportant things, stand forth in a way that they don't. My experience of being under tremendous stress, physical stress or emotional or mental stress, is that things that otherwise just sort of fall outside what we think of as the tunnel of perception, our tunnel vision, kind of spring forward again, and I see them all over again. For me and Gerald's Game, some of the most interesting passages, there's one section where this woman has to get a glass of water off a shelf, and in another one, she realizes that because she is handcuffed to the bed, she can't quite get the glass to her lips. And what she does then was one of the most interesting and challenging parts of writing the book, not because it's an adventure, but because it uses very prosaic, everyday things to make suspense. And so it makes us look at them again and say, oh, what is that? And that's the experience, it seems to me, of brand new perception of childhood, that sort of reaction of, oh, look at that. And maybe the adult doesn't see that thing at all.
What have been your greatest moments of terror in which you've experienced this kind of heightened perception?
Gee, I think probably for me, I remember, I think probably about 4 years after my wife and I were married, we were living in a little western Maine town called North Windham, and there'd been a snowstorm the night before. And my daughter Naomi was about 3, and my son Joe was about a year and a half old, and they had a snow shovel, and they were shoveling off the porch, and I was putting library books in the car because we were going to go to the library, and I heard my son cry out, and when I turned around, he was lying face down in the snow, and my daughter was standing beside him. They had gotten a hold of the shovel, and each one was trying to pull it away from the other one. And my daughter's grip had slipped, and the shovel had come back and cut him severely with the corner in the face. And when I picked him up out of the snow, he appeared to have no face. It was just blood from the hairline to the chin, with one eye staring out of it. And I was convinced that he was going to die. And if he wasn't going to die, he was probably going to lose one of his eyes. And I remember not knowing what to do. But beyond that, I remember very clearly how the sun made all these little tiny sparkles, millions of sparkles off the snow. And I remember very clearly running with him in my arms into the house to use the telephone, and the way the blood splashed in these droplets like coins on the hardwood floor. These are memories that are very clear in my mind, and their clarity stems directly from the fact that, you know, I was over the moon with terror.
Your son healed well?
He did heal well. Yeah, he has a little tiny scar. It severed the optic nerve, but they were able to sew that back together. So he sees, and everything's fine.
Wow. So
not the optic nerve. They couldn't have fixed that. It severed the tear duct.
Huh. Were you already writing when this happened?
Oh, yeah.
Like publishing?
Mm-hmm. I'd published Carrie at that time and Salem's Lot. Two books. I was two books into the job at that point. That's a lot of years ago. Joe is now 20, I think.
After having experienced something like this and experienced the terror of it, how did you feel about going back and writing about this kind of physical terror? Did you feel like now that it had happened to your family, you should kind of back off a little bit?
No, I don't think so. I don't see any correlation between the writing and my daily life in this sense. I don't think that the writing of terrible things serves as some kind of magic hex symbol, like on a barn door. You know, the way that the Amish put the hex signs up, and the idea was to keep the bad luck out of the barn.
Mm-hmm.
They were very religious people. They are very religious people, but that's never stopped them at all from the hex symbols. No more than it stops an atheist, you know, from tossing salt over his shoulder when he spills it. But I never saw the act of writing about terrible things as a way to hedge my bets, a kind of supernatural throwing salt over my shoulder. Nor did I ever think that writing about stories of terror would in some way, you know, cause those things to happen, that it wouldn't do either one. What I can tell you that about this is that I did write a book called Pet Cemetery a few years ago, in which a very small child runs into a road and is run over by a truck and killed. And at that time, when I got ready to write that book, my wife and all three of our kids were living in a little town not too far from where I'm talking to you. And Owen was about the age that Joe was when he got hit by the snow shovel. And at that time, he was just walking or toddling along, and it became great fun to play get away from mother and get away from father. And we were having a picnic, and he got off the blanket and ran straight toward the road, Route 15 up here, which was a very busy road, a lot of trucks going back and forth. And he was running for the road as fast as his little legs could carry him, and I could hear the truck coming. And I ran, and I caught him. And I caught him by one leg, and he went face forward into the gravel on the shoulder of the road. And a few seconds later, the truck went by, a great big one that would have killed us both if we'd gone into the road. And that happens a lot in life. In fact, that's one of the more convincing arguments for the existence of God, is how many times the truck passes us by and how few times it ends up flattening somebody. I mean, obviously the times when somebody gets flattened or, you know, you remember the case where the drunk guy ran into the school bus and 70 people got killed. That made the papers. What doesn't make the papers is all the times that the drunk guy misses the school bus. So when I wrote Pet Cemetery and the truck actually hits the kid, what I was saying to myself is, I want to know what would have happened. I want to explore what life would have been like if my youngest son had been killed instead of, you know, living to be what he is now, which is a big 15-year-old kid who's happy most of the time and getting A's in school and that sort of thing. And I think that it's a really human desire to want to peek through the keyhole into hell.
Stephen King's new novel is Gerald's Game. We'll continue our conversation with Stephen King tomorrow. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. What does it mean to be African? Kwame Anthony Appiah writes, Africans do not have a common traditional culture, common language, a common religious or conceptual vocabulary. We do not even belong to a common race. Appiah was raised in Ghana and now teaches in Harvard's African American Studies program. Coming up, we'll talk about race, identity, and Africa. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new CD of Scherzos by Chopin. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Amid continuing political speculation, President Bush has attempted to stop rumors that he is prepared to oust Vice President Dan Quayle from the Republican ticket. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports from the White House.
In a cabinet meeting this morning, the president responded to one of what he called the crazy rumors out there.
Mr. President, is the vice president's chair a little uncertain these days?
No, it's very certain.
Earlier, spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said Quayle has been doing an outstanding job. Fitzwater also denied reports that Secretary of State James Baker will soon assume a leading role in the Bush campaign. No decision has been made, said the spokesman. Mr. Bush also tried to dispel rumors about his health.
My health is pretty good, though, and I want to challenge the press corps, everybody that's 67 and over, to a race around the Oval here, and maybe run in a few of the younger crowds.
Mr. Bush said he couldn't remember a campaign year being so weird. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
Thousands of people crowded in front of the main library in St. Louis today as Bill Clinton and Al Gore wound up their 1,000-mile bus trip. Clinton told the crowd that the Democratic presidential ticket had traveled from New Jersey to Missouri in what he called a great crusade to give back to the American people their country. Once again, Clinton charged that the top 1% of Americans now control more wealth than the bottom 90%. And he said it's time to create more wealth in a different way. The AIDS virus has swept through Thailand in the last few years, leaving an estimated 300,000 people infected. Now researchers have found that the country has been hit by two distinct epidemics. NPR's Michael Scola reports from the International AIDS meeting underway in Amsterdam.
The first wave of AIDS came in 1988, when a third of all injecting drug users in Bangkok became infected with HIV, the AIDS virus, as they shared needles. Then, a year later, the second wave hit. Researchers from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control reported today that a different strain of HIV entered Thailand and spread to female prostitutes and their clients. This second strain accounts for almost all of the spread of AIDS through sex in Thailand, and it is moving incredibly fast from women to men. Studies of 21-year-old Army recruits in northern Thailand have found that 15% of these men are infected. Investigators don't know yet whether this strain of HIV is passed more easily than others by sex, or whether there's another reason prostitutes in Thailand are infecting so many men. This is Michael Scholar in Amsterdam.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 31 points to close at 3,277.61 on volume of over 190 million shares. Declining issues led advances by a margin of 5-3. This is NPR News. U.S. Envoy Robert Strauss was on Capitol Hill today, calling for more U.S. aid for the former Soviet republics. Strauss said that Russian President Boris Yeltsin is starting to have real political problems, and his survival is in the best interest of the U.S. In moves toward a free market economy, the U.S. diplomat said that prices in Russia have risen 15 to 20% across the board, and consumer goods are now in short supply. The U.S. has again warned Iraq that a renewal of military action has not been ruled out if it continues to defy U.N. ceasefire resolutions. A White House spokesman accused the Iraqi government of using obstructive delaying tactics against U.N. inspectors trying to verify the elimination of weapons of mass destruction. Jonathan Marcus of the BBC reports.
The departure of the United Nations inspection team from outside the agriculture ministry in Baghdad represents a serious reverse for the international effort to track down and destroy Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. There have been similar crises in the past, and ultimately the Iraqi authorities agreed to allow the inspectors to proceed with their work. But this time, Saddam Hussein may believe that with international attention focused on the crisis in what was Yugoslavia, the United States and its principal European allies will not be eager to embark on new military action against Iraq. Officials in London and Washington are stressing that this would be a serious miscalculation on his part. But while nobody doubts that the United States has the available means to strike at Iraq, it is hard to see how many air attacks might be needed to force Saddam Hussein to comply with the conditions of the ceasefire agreement.
Jonathan Marcus at the BBC. The government says that the nation had a $3.78 billion surplus last month for the second time in 3 months. The budget had a deficit of nearly $47 billion in May and a surplus in April. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Many African Americans look to African culture to help them understand their own identities. But my guest says there's no such thing as African culture. There are many cultures within Africa. Kwame Anthony Appiah is from Ghana. His new book, In My Father's House, is about the possibilities and pitfalls of African identity. In a New York Times review, Charles Johnson called the book a ground-clearing analysis of the absurdities and damaging presuppositions that have clouded our discussions on race, Africa, and nationalism since the 19th century. Appiah is a professor in Harvard's African American Studies department. I asked him if he thinks Africa has a different meaning to him than it does to his students.
Short answer, yes. Longer answer, I think that it means different things to different African American students as well. And I think that at different times, and when I'm thinking about different things, Africa can mean different things to me. But I think the fundamental difference is that I think many African Americans think of Africa and their connection with Africa through ideas about race that I have persuaded myself after much thought are incoherent.
An example?
Well, I think that people, for example, are critical of some African Americans who are not interested in Africa on the grounds that if you are an African American, you ought to be interested in Africa. Now, it seems to me that that presupposes that what you ought to be interested in depends ultimately on your race, and I don't think that's true. I think that there are many reasons for being interested in Africa for all Americans and for people all over the world, including Africans. And I try to persuade people when I teach and talk about Africa that its situation is interesting. And I do know that people who feel some connection with Africa by descent are easier audiences. They're more interesting, more likely to be interested. But the fact is that being of African descent doesn't guarantee you any special insight into Africa's situation. And being of African descent doesn't guarantee that you will be interested in Africa. And I think people are entitled to choose whether they want to feel connected with Africa or not.
Will you say that the invention of Africa as something more than a geographical entity is really an outgrowth of European racism?
Yeah, I think that's right. If you want to, you have to start by remembering that Africans themselves, the people of Africa, both north and south of the Sahara, haven't by and large thought of themselves as African for very long. Most of them thought of themselves as Gikuyu or Yoruba or in the north maybe as Muslims or Moroccans. And it's only really in the last 100 years or so that it's, for anyone in Africa, it's been a significant thought that they were an African, that they belonged together with everybody else on the continent. And the people for whom that idea first became important were Africans and African Americans who were educated in Western ideas, 19th century Western ideas, which put race at the very center of thinking about who people were, at the very center of thinking about identity, because by the mid-19th century, one of the central ideas about culture in educated discourse in the Western world was that what your race was very significant in determining what your cultural capacities were, and what and once your cultural capacities had been determined, that was connected with politics through the idea that people who shared culture should live together in nations. And modern nationalism of the sort that we now see doing so much harm in Bosnia and in other parts of Eastern Europe, as well as in South Asia and in Africa, that kind of nationalism is really a modern phenomenon, and it draws on these ideas about race and culture and nation and brings them together in a way that was fundamentally put together after the Enlightenment in Western Europe.
I'd like to put your intellectual views into the context of the environment that you grew up in. You grew up in a family that was part European and part Asante. Mm-hmm. Tell us about your mother and father.
My mother is an English woman. She was raised in the country in England, the daughter of a politician, a British politician. And in her late teens and early 20s, she was a young socialist, as my grandfather was. And she became involved with all sorts of international decolonization movements through church organizations and through something called the World Council of Democratic Youth. And she became very involved just after the war in anti-racist work in Britain. And through that, she met my father, who was a Ghanaian student in London, a law student who was, by the time she met him, president of the West African Students Union, which was an important gathering of West African students in London who were very much preoccupied at that point with getting independence for their various countries. They met, they fell in love, they married, and I was born about a year later, and not long after that my father finished his studies and we went home to Ghana. So the first place I remember is our home in Ghana, in Kumasi.
So were the cultures of both Ghana and England present in your home all the time?
Absolutely. And I would say, when you say Ghana, that's right. It wasn't just Asante. We knew about other parts of Ghana, and we knew about other things in Europe than England. My father made us learn English well, because he thought of English as the only national language in Ghana. It's spoken by more people than anything else, and he wanted us to know English well, but he also wanted us to know French, because it was the second language of Africa. And so we learned about other parts of Africa, other parts of Europe, and we were brought up, I think, believing in the virtue of intercultural and international understanding and friendship.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Kwame Anthony Appiah. His new book is called In My Father's House, Africa in the Philosophy of Culture. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Kwame Anthony Appiah is my guest, and he's a professor of African American Studies at Harvard. Now, what was your religious background? I think you grew up in with Methodist.
Well, I was, I have a religious background that is unfortunately as complicated as,
right.
as everything else. My father, very, and grandfather in Ghana were very active Methodists. They're both very active in the church. My father preached as a lay preacher. My mother was raised an Episcopalian, an Anglican in England, and in fact her father was one of the few laymen to preach in St. Paul's. He was a very devout Anglican too. But And they kept different church lives in Ghana. My father went on with the Methodist Church. My mother became involved in a church which has gradually been taken over by its congregation because she felt, and they felt, increasingly opposed to the kind of breakdown of Christianity into different sects. And so they had a church which was composed of people who had been raised as Copts and Episcopalians and Catholics and Baptists and Pentecostalists, all working together and inviting priests and pastors from different denominations. And that was where I went to Sunday school. So I was brought up in a sort of anti-sectarian, multi-Christian background. We were also taught to respect the Muslims in our country. We obviously had Muslim friends and Muslims visiting the house. And in fact, I have Muslim cousins. And I remember one of the most enjoyable parts of the year was Ramadan, because they were fasting all day, they had wonderful feasts at night.
Now, growing up in a Christian family, were you still aware of traditional Asante beliefs and customs? And how was that integrated into the house?
That it only occurs to me looking back how much we were also brought up in a world which acknowledged the traditional religion of Asante. But we did, and it shows up everywhere in the most basic features of daily life. In Asante, if you open a bottle of spirits, or if you start a new keg of palm wine, you pour some on the ground for the ancestors and you say a little prayer mentioning the names of the founder of your family and some important ancestors. And this can be relatively at a low key. It doesn't feel like a very grand or over-invested event, but it happens all the time. And certainly whenever my father opened a bottle, he'd pour some. Sometimes he'd go to the edge of the room not to pour it on the carpet. And he would say something. So I learned, one of the ways in which I learned the names of our ancestors was by hearing these libations in a very ordinary context.
Yeah, well, I'm wondering how your beliefs in spirits, your feelings about spirits, have survived a contemporary European education. You were educated in Cambridge, you know, because I think for a lot of people, intellectualism makes it difficult, if not impossible, to believe in certain
yes,
traditional beliefs.
Yes. I have to say that they haven't survived in my own case, really.
Mm-hmm.
I once had a conversation with my father at the end of the evening on Ghanaian television. They alternated, or they used to alternate, the national hymn and the national anthem. And my father was saying that the national hymn, which mentions God, of course, ought to be used to replace the national anthem. And I said, but that would be a pity for Ghanaians who were not theists. And my father said, there aren't any Ghanaians who are that stupid. And it is true that atheism, not just atheism about God, the high God, but atheism about other gods, is extremely unusual in Ghana. And but the fact is that, as a result of all sorts of things in my education, I myself find it no longer possible to believe in them. But I still must say that I find many of the rituals that go with both Christian and non-Christian religious life in Ghana tremendously moving. And when my father died and the time came for his funeral, I don't think it would have been as easy for us, myself and my sisters, to deal with it if we hadn't had those forms, both the Christian ones and the libations to the ancestors, as part of our support.
Given all the thought you've put into African literature and African-American literature and so on and so on, what do you think of the controversy over Afrocentric curricula?
Well, I think that the first thing you have to understand about Afrocentrism is that it has a great deal to do with the disintegration of urban America,
mm-hmm.
Black America, and not much to do with Africa. It's an attempt to reclaim a sense of community in a place where real communities are falling apart. And so Africa is very largely a sort of symbolic element in Afrocentrism. Having said that, and I should also say that I think that, unfortunately, some Afrocentrists have borrowed the worst features of Eurocentrism. That is, they have simply turned it on its head and said, you said everything European was best, now we're saying everything African-derived is best. And that's the wrong lesson to draw. The lesson that I think you should draw from the history of Eurocentrism is the lesson I tried to draw earlier, that human beings as a whole have much to gain from being rooted in traditions, but learning to respect and live with others. So what I think about an Afrocentric curriculum is that all American students ought to know more about Africa and Asia and about the history of African Americans and about the differences between the kinds of ways in which the American population was made up, with immigrants and slaves, and different kinds of immigration from Europe and Asia at different times, and with an increasing appreciation of the fascinating intellectual, cultural, moral, religious lives of people all around the planet. I think that's good, but I don't think that there's any reason why that should be taught just to black kids any more than I think it was right when black kids were only taught about European culture and were presented with it as if it was a gift from somebody else. The point is that culture belongs to anybody who's willing to do the work to claim it. You know, if you're willing to do the work of claiming European culture, then it's just as much yours as somebody with a white skin. And similarly, I think people with white skins ought to be interested in doing the work to claim an appreciation of the fascinating, rich, and wonderful lives in culture of Africans over the centuries.
Kwame Anthony Appiah is the author of In My Father's House, Africa in the Philosophy of Culture. He's a professor of African American Studies at Harvard. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. As you know, a lot of rumor and speculation today in Washington and among Republicans around the country. Will James Baker, now the Secretary of State, step down and run Mr. Bush's reelection campaign? Will Dan Quayle step out of the ticket? The White House is denying that, by the way. Elizabeth Arnold reports on all that today. Ann Garrels reports on what the Baker move could mean at the State Department, if indeed it happens. We'll talk with a Ross Perot supporter in California who's helping organize something called Owners of America to change politics in this country. Deborah Amos analyzes the issue of possible bomb attacks against Iraq, and we'll talk with an expert about the sanctions now in place.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Italian pianist Maurizio Pollini, who's now 50, has always been in the rarefied category of celebrated performers who are essentially artists, as opposed to celebrities who are essentially celebrities. Classical music critic Lord Schwartz says, for Pollini, expressing the music comes before any self-promoting expression of personality. Pollini has produced relatively few recordings, so each one is eagerly anticipated. Lloyd has a review of Pollini's latest, a Chopin disc.
Except for three full-length sonatas and two concertos, Chopin is generally regarded as a miniaturist. Most of his works are either single movements or collections of short movements, etudes and preludes, nocturnes, waltzes and mazurkas. Maurizio Pollini devotes his latest album to the four scherzos, which are among Chopin's most ambitious pieces, works that stretch both the limits of the piano and the single movement form. Each scherzo is as long as a symphonic movement. Scherzo is the Italian for joke, but in music it's more specifically a term for the kind of movement that early in the Romantic period replaced the classical minuet. The four pieces come from different stages of Chopin's all-too-brief career, and they are decidedly no joke. Each one is grand in scope, with dramatically contrasting themes of public and private heroism. Like Byron, Chopin seems to defy or question the state of the world, and sometimes finally comes to accept it. Chopin's best-known scherzo is probably the second, Opus 31 in B minor. It begins with a question, a mysterious pair of triplets in whispered, rising thirds that Chopin marked sotto voce, and these questions get an immediate and defiant reply. As in each of the other scherzos, the rhetoric is interrupted with something more inward, a searching, meditative passage that for a moment tries to console. Then there's a poignant little waltz in C-sharp minor that keeps threatening to go out of control. The original question keeps coming back, and the answers get even angrier. The second scherzo ends with a plummeting, over-the-edge, almost self-destructive determination not to be defeated. At the heart of each of the four scherzos is a passage of inspired songfulness. Here's my own favorite from the elegant fourth scherzo. As a bonus, this disc includes two of Chopin's most appealing isolated works, the Heavenly Berceuse, or Lullaby, and the exhilarating Barcarolle. Pollini plays them all impeccably. Every note sounds, even in the densest, most finger-twisting passage work. Some people might prefer a more hard-on-sleeve approach, something higher in cholesterol. Pollini doesn't gush. But he gives these works a rare seriousness, grandeur, and unsentimental nobility.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and author of the new collection of poems, Good Night, Gracie. He reviewed pianist Maurizio Pollini's new Chopin disc on Deutsche Grammophon. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, part two of our interview with Stephen King about writing horror fiction. Also, we talk with singer Jimmy Scott. He has a new album. It's his first in over 15 years. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
The book is called A Cure for Dreams. Listen and call in tomorrow at 10 on WHYY.